Seated to my right is my assistant, John Cotty, and Mr. Halbin's the gentleman seated in the back. As you know, Mr. Halbin was injured in a motor vehicle collision, which occurred in August of 2000. He's been waiting 17 years in order to get this matter resolved. The case initially was tried to a circuit court jury in Milwaukee County with the Honorable Francis Wasilewski presiding. The jury rendered a verdict awarding to Mr. Halbin the sum of $182,250. The case at that time, Mr. Barrick was representing Mr. Halbin, and during his closing arguments made certain comments that the court found to be derogatory, and a mistrial was granted. There was an appeal made from that mistrial, and that was presented by Mr. Barrick. At that time, there was a contingent fee agreement initially, which provided that Mr. Barrick was entitled to one-third of any recovery, together with his costs and disbursements, and that in the event of an appeal, he would have been entitled to 50% of any recovery, together with his costs and disbursements.
Counsel, just to preserve your time for argument, could I jump in and just, I want to get my line wrapped around, what are the damages in this case? How much, and how did you determine what they were?
What happened is, initially, Judge Pocan in Milwaukee County had the case. Judge Pocan made a ruling when there was a motion made to exclude the original judgment in the amount of $182,000 plus. The second trial, a judgment came in approximately $34,000, which was reduced by setoffs to $29,650-some.
So what's the damage?
Well, that's an issue. And the issue is this. It's Judge Pocan found that the damages were from the second verdict. One of our arguments is that the jury should have been able to receive evidence concerning both of the jury trials, the $182,000 and the $29,000.
All right. Let's set aside for a moment the question of whether evidence of the prior verdict should have been admissible. Let's say it's not. What's your damage?
In this case? Hmm. Well, let me explain where I would be coming from. Had I had the opportunity to deal with the first...
No, hang on a second. One of the issues we have in this is that the judge said there was never a definitive number given to the jury. So I want to hear a definitive number. What's the damage?
Based upon Judge Pocan's decision, would be $29,564.
How did you arrive at that?
Pardon me?
How did you arrive at that?
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you.
I'm sorry. How did you arrive at that number?
Based upon Judge Pocan's rulings.
Yes.
But in our opinion, we should have...
What was the calculation?
The calculation was the second jury verdict.
Okay. So you're saying the damages were the amount of the second jury verdict?
We don't believe so. Judge Pocan said that. He ruled as a matter of law...
Judge Pocan, I believe, said... there was no evidence of damage, and that's why the case got dismissed.
No, that's Judge Maroney.
Okay, Judge
Maroney. Let me give you a little background on it, then it'll help.
What I want to know is the damage figure and how we figured out. Let's set aside for a moment that you don't get the difference between the first and second jury verdicts. Okay, so if I understand the briefs correctly, your damages are the cost incurred for the second trial. Would that be correct?
The award of the second trial would have been the damages that were presented at the trial before Judge Maroney, who heard this case.
Now, damages for the malpractice. What do you get for damages for the malpractice?
Well, I can explain that, though. I can't answer that question. I don't want to be argumentative, but here's the situation. Ordinarily, in a malpractice case, you prove a case within a case to arrive at your damages.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, because Judge Pocan, who initially had this case before it went to Judge Maroney, had made a determination that the damages were that $29,654. On that basis, we tried the case, even though we had initially argued that we had the right to present relevant evidence, which included both jury verdicts. Had we had both jury verdicts, I would have brought in medical testimony also to prove the case within a case, and therefore the damages would have been whatever the jury assessed as damages.
But you didn't need to have a trial within a trial or a case within a case, which is the usual paradigm under Lewandowski and in most legal malpractice cases, because here an actual real jury rendered a verdict in the second trial. And how is that inconsistent with Lewandowski? Because as Lewandowski tells us, the ultimate goal should be to determine what the outcome should have been if the issue had been properly presented in the first instance. Here, a court has found that it wasn't properly presented in the first trial, so Mr. Haldeman got a second kick at the cat, if you will. So why should we disregard the fact that he got a second verdict?
Because the first verdict would have been relevant. It was relevant evidence under the statutes. And therefore, because of that, even though there was some indication there may have been prejudice based upon Mr. Barrick's comments, there was no definitive findings that there was prejudice. The court was concerned that there may have been prejudice based upon the comments made by Mr. Barrick, consisting of, among others, that Farmers Insurance Company had paid the property damage when, in fact, there was an issue as to whether or not the driver of the Farmers Insurance car had collided with Mr. Barrick's motor vehicle.
The trial courts don't lightly grant a mistrial, do they?
I'm sorry, again, I'm not hearing you.
Trial courts do not lightly grant motions for a mistrial, do they?
No.
They don't want to have to try the case again.
No.
Right. So,
I agree with you.
But here, don't you think that the judge, it was Judge Wasilewski, I believe, was saying that the verdict was so infected that even though I don't want to have to retry this case, I don't want everybody else to have to retry the case, we're going to have to do it again.
Well, I think that was the ruling. That's the basis of the ruling. I agree.
Doesn't that vitiate the relevance of the first jury verdict?
I don't believe so, but again, it's...
Well, how can you have as admissible evidence a verdict that results from a mistrial? How is that relevant to anything in the world?
Well, then it should have been an open issue on what the damages are so we could, again, prove the case within a case. And there's two reasons for that. Number one, in the first case, two drivers were found to be negligent. There was an intersection collision.
I don't want to relitigate the merits of the original case. You had the case within a case. It just happened seriatim as opposed to concurrently. Got the second trial. The value there, uninfected by whatever caused the mistrial, was $36,000. So why are we interested in what a verdict was that resulted from a mistrial?
All right. Well, even if you assume you're correct in your evaluation and you're dealing with a $29,000 verdict, then you get into the issue of when we're trying the case to Judge Maroney, we present evidence concerning the contract that was entered into. We presented evidence that Mr. Barrick had also now decided that he wanted to charge $200 an hour for an appeal. We had an expert testify that he deviated below the standard, and that created the substantial problem that evolved. And in addition to that, we presented evidence. And if you look at that evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff at that juncture, which is the case law and also the statute, you are at a point where we would have been entitled to 2/3 of any recovery, assuming the 30 or the $29,000 figure was available. At that juncture, why would we have to prove the costs and disbursements by Mr. Barrick?
Couldn't you have done that easily, though, by subpoenaing Mr. Barrick's records?
His deposition was taken and his records were brought in, but he was in the courtroom, so we didn't subpoena him. We had him to use, but they were all over the board. Are we responsible for the cost of the first trial? Are we responsible for the cost of the appeal and also paying an hourly fee and a contingent fee? Are we responsible for the cost in the second trial?
But now you're getting to the heart of what Mr. Haldeman's damages could be. It's not the difference between the verdicts, arguably. It's the fact that he had to go through a second trial And we don't know, based on the record before us, at least my examination of it, we don't know if he was supposed to pay his attorney twice. If that were the case, then I think his measure of damages, arguably, is the cost of that second trial. He got a verdict. He got his day in court. Why isn't the proper measure of damages the extra costs he might have incurred to go through a second trial?
Well, because he was the injured party, and he would have gotten two-thirds of whatever recovery also. So there's all kinds of issues here.
Minus his attorney's costs per their contract, correct?
Correct.
On the
first trial.
Does the contract also provide, or is there other, in other ways, provision that upon receipt of the money from the insurance company, and assuming it was placed in a trust account, that there would be an accounting? In other words, didn't Attorney Barak give you the accounting of what the costs and disbursements were from that trust account?
No, what happened is we got documents. They were all over the board. They differed. That's why I wanted to examine him adversely. His deposition had been taken. The problem is the check came into his office, made out to both Mr. Haldeman and the Barak's law firm. Mr. Haldeman went into the office and said, I'm here to get my portion of the settlement. Mr. Barak told him, you're not getting anything, or you're getting $100. Sign the check for Mr. Haldeman, and left the office and never signed the check.
But wasn't there an accounting that was given to you?
No, it wasn't given to anybody at that point in time. Later on, we were given sheets of whatever the costs were, but you couldn't interpret them because they included both the first case, the second case, the appeal, and that's why we wanted to him to testify adversely at the trial, and he was there in the morning and then left the courtroom. And he
All right, counsel, so if I hear you correctly, you're saying the information that you have prevented you from being able to tell what costs were associated with which trial, correct?
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
So the judge says we're going to dismiss this. It's not going to go to the jury because they would be engaged in speculation. From what you just said, that sounds about right.
That wouldn't have been speculation because at that juncture, if you look at the evidence most favorable to the plaintiff, there were no costs presented. And therefore, at that point, if you look at the evidence and in the light most favorable to us, at that point we'd be entitled to two-thirds. If Mr. Barak never showed up, there'd be no cost.
Wait. Now you're confusing the amount of your recovery from the trial versus what's available to you for malpractice, right? So what you're trying to get from Mr. Barak is the increased cost of having to go through a second trial, right?
Correct.
All right. So this is not a question of the two-thirds after subtraction of costs. You're trying to figure out, you have to tell the jury what were the costs, right? That's the damage. All right. So and you just told us that you couldn't figure out what that number should be. So how is the jury supposed to figure it out?
Well, because the jury could have ignored the cost. They could have done whatever they want once they heard the conduct of Mr. Barak in handling this case. They could have taken the position that based upon the fact that a mistrial was granted, based upon the fact that my client had to go through an appeal, that they could have taken the position that he's not entitled to costs. They could have even found that he wasn't entitled to attorney's fees based upon his conduct.
Well, counsel, did the jury in the second case also hear that your client had some role to play in the mistrial?
I wasn't privy to that case. I don't know what transpired. I didn't get into the case till after the fact. And there's no question that he did make some comments before Judge Wasilewski.
Well, three times, at least three times, you've alluded to Mr. Barak's comments. But my reading of the record from the original trial court, from the original trial, shows that the circuit court found that it was the inappropriate responses and statements of your client that contributed to the mistrial, which were, in the trial court's words, exacerbated by the closing arguments of Mr. Barrick. But Mr. Barrick's argument to that, what I'd like you to address, is his response, which he made in his briefs, which is, look, I didn't get a ruling on the objections that were made at the first trial. I didn't get a definitive ruling from the trial court. I got a counseling to be cautious or be careful on closing, but I never got a ruling that the statements made by my then client were that the objection was granted and that the comments were stricken. And so therefore, as I read the record, I thought to myself, okay, I mean, as a circuit court judge, I tried never to leave such gaps open. People knew what the ruling was. They knew. Often in error, never in doubt, some might say. But they knew what the ruling was. And here it doesn't seem to me that the lawyers knew what the circuit court judge's ruling was. And so if I'm the lawyer charged with making the closing argument, I've got these statements that my client made that were the subject of some discussion, but never stricken from the record. What's he supposed to do? What's he supposed to do on his closing with statements that are made and that are not stricken from the record, that the judge did not order stricken from the record, so they're part of the record? Shouldn't he make use of them on closing?
No, when a judge tells you, be careful, Mr. Barrick, and he also tells your client not to make those kinds of comments, and if you know the law, it's very clear that one of the things you don't do is you don't make a statement that an insurance company had paid damages for two reasons. Number one, it's prejudicial to the insurance company, who's to be treated as any other party, and number two, it deals with the settlement-type situation that evolves in a case. You can't go into a trial and say, look, they made an offer of settlement of $45,000.
Right, because if you do, the judge will admonish you and may take other steps, but the judge will make it clear to you that what you did is impermissible, and depending on how infected the judge finds the fact-finding proceeding to have been by it, could declare a mistrial then, or could give cautionary instructions. My question is here, given the lack of direction from the circuit court, I mean, we can talk about what people should know, but that doesn't take away the fact that it's up to the trial court judge to run the trial court judge's courtroom and to make the expectations for everyone clear so that everyone knows what the rules are and everyone knows what lines they have to stay within. And if they go without, then let the wrath fall down. But it seems to me, and I'm curious to know, other than, gee, he just should have known, if he's got an experienced trial court judge which has refused to definitively rule on the objections that have been made and has definitively and has expressly failed to strike the, what everybody feels, I guess, what I get the tenor of the brief, everyone kind of felt it was inappropriate, but I don't have anything in the record to show that the trial court said, this is wrong, this is contrary to law, this is not within conformity with the rules. If you do it again, I'm going to declare a mistrial and I'm going to sanction you. So what should he have done under those circumstances? Just stayed away from it, ignored his client's comments?
Well, I believe that you would have, because you were instructed by the court to be careful and not to make those comments. And I think the appellate court...
Did the court say, don't make those comments?
No.
No. Be careful.
Be careful would tell me, don't make those comments.
Counsel, can you tell me what evidence, witness, or testimony you presented to prove your damages?
Well, we brought in the contract, which provided what the damages were in terms of what Mr. Barrick was entitled to.
Who put the contract into evidence? What witness testified?
Mr. Haldeman testified that this was a contract that he entered into. I'm talking about the contingent fee agreement. He also testified.
Okay, so that told the jury what was due.
Correct.
What amount?
I'm sorry.
What's the dollar figure that was due under that contract that the jury, if they read it in the jury room, would know this amount is due?
At that juncture, at the plaintiff's close of the evidence, two-thirds of the amount would have been due because, again, we didn't pay the cost. I don't believe we had the obligation.
What's the amount that the jury had before it?
Two-thirds of $29,654.
Who introduced the testimony of $29,000?
That was the check that was introduced into evidence with the name of both Mr. Haldeman and Barrick Law Firm. That was introduced into evidence also. The other document that was introduced into evidence was the letter from Mr. Barrick that indicated now that he's doing the appeal, he's going to charge $200 per hour for the appeal, in addition to the contingent fee agreement.
Counsel,
okay.
I'm sorry.
Is it your position that there would be no costs going forward to try the second case?
I'm sorry.
Would there be no costs going forward to try?
I don't know what the costs would have been at that juncture because we had three trials, two of which, in my opinion, were created by Mr. Barrick.
Okay.
The appeal and the second trial.
So I thought I heard you say earlier that really the crux of your case depended on Mr. Barrick's testimony, but that's not the case?
Well, it would have been based on his testimony, correct. If he had testified, these were the costs. What we would have done is question him about the costs on the various cases.
Did you need his testimony to prove your case?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't think I have the obligation to prove any costs in a case like this because
you're the
I
plaintiff.
Didn't pay the cost.
You're the plaintiff. The
correct.
Plaintiff has the burden to prove damages. So as the plaintiff's lawyer, what did you introduce that proved your damages without Mr. Barrick's testimony?
The contract proved our damages, in my opinion.
Because the contract gave one number.
Correct.
And you're saying that that one number is something your client wrongfully paid.
Well, my client testified he had also paid some money to Mr. Barrick. There were checks introduced into evidence that he paid for the towards the costs. He testified he spent $10,000 to $15,000 by giving him cash and an offset against some landscaping that he had done for Mr. Barrick. So we couldn't prove the costs, frankly.
So your client didn't owe any costs under the terms of the contract?
He thought he had paid the majority of the costs or all of the costs. And we don't know if it was the cost for the first trial, for the appeal, for the second trial. We didn't know what those costs were based upon the record that was presented.
Then back to Justice Kelly's question, if you don't know, how is the jury to do anything but speculate?
If Mr. Barrick had been called adversely or had taken the stand, he would have testified as to what the cause was.
And I mean this respectfully, but it's been my experience that if you want to secure a witness, you need to actually subpoena the witness to come to court. Did you ask for a bench warrant? Did you secure the witness's testimony? Did you have opposing counsel's assurance in writing that he would be present and available to testify?
He was present on the second day of trial and was gone.
Respectfully, though, you know that subpoenas serve a purpose. They require an appearance by someone to come testify in court, and they're available to you to use. What assurance did you have that he would be there when you wanted him to testify?
Well, if I could have called him the day before, he was there, and number two, in 49
That's not my
years,
question. What did you do as a lawyer to assure that he would be available to testify?
No, I didn't do anything.
Okay.
Did the trial court order his appearance for trial?
No.
Did you ask for a bench warrant?
No.
On the issue of costs, is it any costs or reasonable costs?
Well, I think it would be any costs that you could prove are related to the incident that you're dealing with. In other words,
reasonable and necessary, then? Is that your answer?
I think it would be reasonable and necessary. Now, everyone deals with it differently, of course, if you have video depositions and all kinds of extra things. But if it flows from that action, those would be the costs that you would utilize.
Counsel,
it's the costs and expenses, whether we decide that they're reasonable and necessary, that were incurred in prosecuting the personal injury case. Is that what you're entitled to? Is that the rule of damages?
I believe the first case only.
Okay. So it's the costs and expenses incurred in the personal injury case that you're entitled to.
I believe in the first case, yes.
All right. So you're the plaintiff, and that's what you're entitled to. So what evidence did you put in to show those costs and expenses?
We couldn't put in evidence without Mr. Berg.
But you didn't put in any evidence.
Correct.
Therefore, the case went against you, and the trial court said, plaintiff, it's your obligation to prove damages, and you put in no evidence, therefore, you lose. Now
that's what the court basically said.
That's right. And that, it's generally good law that the plaintiff has the burden of proof of all the elements, including damages.
If we had paid him, I would agree with the court. I respectfully disagree with that. If we didn't pay him, I don't think it's our obligation.
If you didn't pay it, it's not your obligation. You're saying you had no obligation to prove damages.
No, I had obligation to prove the damages in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, which we did at that juncture after.
What was that? What was the evidence that you put in?
The contract that says we're entitled to 2/3, the amount that was recovered, and the fact that at that juncture we would have been entitled almost to $20,000.
Didn't the contract also call
the red light is on?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you very much. I'll save my question for later. Thank you. You're set to go, counsel, for a reply.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Attorney Mitchell Barrick. I'm the respondent in this case.
Mr. Barrick,
why did you think we took this case?
I'm sorry, didn't hear you.
Why do you think the court took this case when the rule is plaintiff has to prove damages? The plaintiff agrees he didn't put in proof of damages other than the contract, and the court held against the plaintiff. Why do you think the Supreme Court accepted the case? Yeah, why? The Supreme Court, why did we take this case?
Your Honor, in all honesty, I have been wrestling with that question because I know the court does not accept cases like this very lightly.
What was the error here? We take cases that we don't usually take cases to correct errors. We take cases to develop the law. But sometimes we even take cases to correct errors when the court or three members of the court are sufficiently offended. What's the error here that's so offensive?
He doesn't think there is one.
I know. That's why I'm asking this question. I haven't figured it out either.
Counsel,
Your Honor, if I may say one thing.
Yeah. I'd like you to try and help me figure out what is legal development or correction of an error in this case.
The only reason that I speculated on was that the court accepted this case to try to clarify the law on this isolated, particular, unique issue.
Okay, what's the law on this isolated, particular issue?
That's my suspicion.
But what's the legal issue? What's the isolated legal issue that you think the court wanted to clarify?
The only thing that I could think of was that the court would accept it to say that if the case has already been tried a second time, it creates a mechanism for measuring damages.
Because this case doesn't really fit the Lewandowski paradigm of the typical legal malpractice case.
I would agree.
Well, you know what? Sometimes we take cases and they're argued and they turn out to look a little different after you hear the parties completely out. So who knows what at least three of us were thinking when this case was taken. But you have a sentence in your contract. It says, any costs incurred by the attorneys, including judgment costs, investigation, and expert fees, shall be repaid to the attorneys from the client's portion of the recovery and shall be paid directly by the clients if the recovery is unsuccessful. What do you think that sentence means?
That means that this provision dovetails with the ethical requirements that an attorney cannot take a personal interest in a case. We can advance costs on behalf of the clients, but we cannot put ourselves in an adverse position with the client saying, well, I put money into the case, I'm not going to allow you to dismiss it because I have my personal money into this case.
So the client is responsible for the costs, whether you prevail or not?
Yes.
Counsel, does the costs in the contract mean, under the law, any costs that are reasonable and necessary?
I heard the court ask that question earlier. I don't know. I would take the position that if the costs were paid, that they would be a recoverable cost. If the client disputes it and takes issue with it, we would have to address that somewhere down the road. But usually, statutory costs are not the same as costs coming out of the contract because we all know that many of the costs are not recoverable.
Well, let me ask it in the reverse then. Do you think it appropriate for an attorney to charge costs that are not reasonable and necessary?
No.
Okay. So inherent in the any costs means any costs that are reasonable and necessary. Who has the burden to prove that the costs are reasonable and necessary or show that the costs are reasonable and necessary?
I guess under what circumstances or what situation? I mean, if we're going to court and we say, Judge, here's our bill of costs, we would have to prove what is reasonable and necessary, which might be different than what I would present to a client because, again, many costs are not recoverable, such as mediation costs, which I've always thought should be recoverable. They're not recoverable.
We're not talking about 814 under the Wisconsin statutes in terms of costs and what costs are recoverable. We're talking about an attorney fee agreement for costs, as the agreement says, incurred in and whatever the rest of the language says, any costs. My concern is this. And I understand there wasn't an account. Let me ask, was there an accounting that you gave upon the completion of your services to your client?
Oh, very detailed accounting with a copy of all receipts and all
bills.
Is
that in the record?
No, it never got into the record, but it would have if I had taken the stand.
Why didn't you? And that's a document that that the plaintiff in this case received?
They had everything well in advance, a copy of all bills, all receipts, all disbursements, the accountings, everything.
Counsel, I'm not going to ask you to tell me the dollar figure, but do you know what the costs were for the second trial?
I would assume, from my recollection, it's approximately $2,000 to $3,000 maybe. The vast majority of the costs were from the first case.
Is that in the record, though? That's really what you're asking, right?
Well, yeah. In a second. So is that discernible from the documents that you provided to the plaintiff?
Yes. Everything was itemized, and you could tell by the dates as to when they were incurred.
So you could tell which costs were attributable to which trial?
Yes.
How come you were not at trial during the entirety of the proceedings?
Because I had spoken to my trial counsel, and we had realized that the plaintiff had not proven the case. In order to get certain evidence in, I would have to be present. And I was not listed as a witness. I was listed as a witness, but I was not subpoenaed as a witness, so I chose not to be present.
Is that part of the record? I'm concerned about going into, we're not the trial court here, so I'm just concerned about, so from my perspective, when you're going into answers, please indicate whether it's part of the current record.
What's part of the current record is you were not there.
I was not present
at a particular day.
On the second day of trial, at the beginning of the second day of trial, I did show up, but it was I was late. But in a civil case, I'm not required to be present during the trial.
I just don't want to get
We're
into your personal
what Justice Eagler is getting at, not that she needs my interpretation services, but just so everyone's clear. We're supposed to decide the case only on what appears on the record. And sometimes a justice may inadvertently ask for information that is not within the record before this court. And if so, we're merely asking you to preface your response by saying that's not in the record. And then probably you shouldn't answer.
I'm not trying to misrepresent. If the court asks me a question, I will answer honestly. But my recollection was that there was nothing on the record of my appearance on the second day of trial.
Well, there's usually an appearance that the court states and the attorney state on the second day of trial, and if you weren't there, it wouldn't show in the statement.
I think
of appearances, right?
I believe that it would probably, if I looked at the record, it would probably reflect that Attorney Johnson appeared on my behalf as my representative.
Right. Okay, that's right. So it's on the record. You were not there.
Correct.
All right. Now, what's the rule of damages that applies in this case? As I understand it, that the rule that of damages would be the amount of costs and expenses incurred in prosecuting the personal injury case, the second case. Is that right?
The difference between the costs in the first case and the additional costs in the second case?
The costs of the second case, not the first case.
That would be the measure of damages?
Yeah, isn't it? If not, tell me what you think the measure of damages is. Because the first thing I like to know is what's the measure of damages? The second thing I then want to know is what evidence was introduced to prove that measure of damages?
Good, very good questions, Your Honor.
So what's the measure of damages here?
I don't think we have a measure of damages that was ever presented. That's the problem. If I was plaintiff counsel, I would say, well, here are the costs from the first case.
Okay, tell me that what you're doing is telling me what you think the measure of damages
is. I would think that I would take the costs from the first case and say, had it not been for the malpractice, or because of the malpractice, I incurred these additional costs from the second case. And the difference between the two, which is, again, my estimation is approximately $2,000 to $3,000, that would be the total measure of damages. However,
why the difference? Why not the both?
But it's not just that, Your Honor. It's also the measure of damages is, per the terms of contract, one-third plus or minus the costs, which are taken out before the one-third even comes out. Now, the question that this court may want to know is, was Mr. Hallman aware of that? Did he agree to that? And if we look at the transcript from the trial itself, which is, I believe, R100, page number 152, the question was asked by Mr. Levine of Mr. Hallman, where he said, now pursuant to the agreement, what were you to pay Mr. Barra? Answer, one-third. And you were to pay, in addition to one-third, any recovery of costs, any court costs. Is that true? Answer, yes. So Mr. Hallman was aware that in this contract case, it's not just one-third, it's the cost, something that counsel has conveniently left out of this argument here, because when you say one-third is a measure of damages, you can't exclude the cost. They go hand in hand. And I think Judge Maroney pointed this out very articulately on the record when he said, this is a joint obligation. The two of you entered into contract together. You can't just say it's one-third. It's one-third plus cost.
The problem I have, and you could probably tell by my line of questioning earlier, deals with that I have concerns that the plaintiff is responsible for proving the costs which the attorney is asserting are reasonable and necessary when the plaintiff doesn't believe they are reasonable and necessary. And so normally it isn't the plaintiff's
role to prove the reasonableness and necessity of costs claimed by the attorney. And yet in this case, that responsibility is being thrusted upon the plaintiff to establish a prima facie case, given the procedural posture.
Mm-hmm. And I think the problem with that question, Your Honor, is that the plaintiff in the record never challenged the reasonableness of the bills. That's not an issue for this court to consider. And when I say that with all due respect, that was never raised as to what's reasonable at the trial. He didn't say, well, we're not challenging that this bill's reasonable, that bill's reasonable. The only argument from counsel was, well, why is it my responsibility to prove damages and prove costs? He never said that anything was unreasonable. So I can't get into an argument like that when the record really doesn't reflect that as an issue.
There's just something asymmetrical about that. I borrow from this court's experience in OLR cases when we're dealing with trust accounts that are oftentimes a mess and the issue of restitution. And although certainly it's not on all fours, there is something similar that on occasion the response is, well, the victim didn't prove the amount that should be returned from the retainer fee or whatever it is. And I think who is in a better position to come up with the documents and to bear that burden than the attorney once a prima facie case is and claim is made. So I know that's not on all fours, but there is, to me, uniquely the responsibility of the attorney to know and to assert and can only assert reasonable and necessary costs.
Mm-hmm. In this particular case, Your Honor, I don't disagree with the foundational statement that counsel is in a better position to prove what the costs are. I mean, clearly, if my office is the one that incurred the bills and paid the bills, nobody would know better than I as to what the costs would be. Again, this case, though, that was never really an issue as to what was fair and reasonable. It's a question of whether there were any cost, and there was nothing presented in this case. I mean, zippo. Bigger problem that the court has to wrestle with is the fact that in this particular case, the only indication of damages was a check for approximately $29,653, and Mr. Hallman saying, well, I paid another $10,000 to $15,000, and that's all we have. Now a jury has to say, okay, what are the damages? Well, we don't know. Mr. Hallman doesn't even know what he put in, claim allegedly put in, which was false to begin with, but immaterial. The point is, there's still no accuracy that a jury can look at this and say, well, I think damages are what? Without speculating. It's all speculation.
But counsel, isn't opposing counsel's argument really that your costs are an affirmative defense for you to raise and prove? He put in that the jury awarded $29,000-some-odd after offset by the check, and it was for his client's claim. And he didn't put in your costs because he essentially views them as the jury should give him the whole thing. If you don't think a whole thing is due, well, then you have to put in your costs, sort of as an affirmative defense. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is there's a contract also, which does acknowledge that costs are due. So I think it's because of the contract, when combined with the check, that the costs rise up as a portion of damages. At least that's the way I'm hearing it argued. But basically the argument is, hey, if you had costs, you should prove them. Otherwise, I don't have to prove them. It's your affirmative defense.
I hear the court, but yeah. And that's what I've been wrestling with, because to assert such a position, it violates the terms of basic logic under inductive or deductive reasoning. The conclusion has to be supported by the premise. And if the premise in this case is that I have to prove costs to begin with to prove my case, then the conclusion of it's not my responsibility doesn't fly, because the premise is not supported by the premise.
If they had just put the check in and said this was the damages, this is what we deserve, two-thirds of this, end of story, But there is also the contract, which acknowledges that their right to damages is infringed upon by the costs that are reasonable, correct?
It is.
And I think it's that interplay which caused the courts below to conclude that the jury couldn't figure out what the damages were because they couldn't figure out how to measure the second part of the contract.
No, and again, that relates directly to Mr. Hallman's testimony, R100, page 156, line 1, where he was questioned and says, incidentally, did you pay any of the costs in connection with the trial? Answer, yes. Question, do you have an estimate as to approximately how much of the cost you paid towards the trial of this matter? Answer, I'd say $10,000 to $15,000. Again, saying $10,000 to $15,000 is not an exact number that a jury can look at and say, okay, now we're going to try to calculate what the damages are. So we have a check for $29,000. We have Mr. Hallman putting in a phantom amount that's uncertain, and we don't know what the costs are. But Mr. Hallman acknowledges that part of the contract, per the contract, he has to pay the cost. Where are we going to go? I mean, I can understand why Judge Maroney was flipping his hands up saying, where are we going to go from here? Because we can't prove the damages. If I can't see them, how can a jury see them?
Can't the plaintiff, and I'm just going to follow up on the question, because opinions can be written in various ways, obviously. I mean, I could see an opinion being written saying, based on the facts, that the plaintiff made a prima facie case. Again, we're talking about a low threshold of and asks for two-thirds of the $29,000 check. And if you want to prove reasonable and necessary costs being asserted pursuant to the contract, that's your affirmative defense. And why is it your affirmative defense? Because no one in the world is better suited to know what is reasonable and necessary than the attorney asserting the reasonableness and necessity of the expenses. It's not just any expense. You can't, as an attorney, get any expense, only reasonable and necessary. So I could write an opinion like that. I'm not saying I will, and I'm not saying I should, but you know, that, with a few citations, that might fly. So tell me why that would be wrong.
I'd be wrong because the record reflects that that is not an issue in this case. The reasonableness of the bills is not an issue. It never has been an issue. Reasonableness is not being challenged. If it's not being challenged, then I think it would be, with all due respect, inappropriate to try to force this case into that little category and say, well, I'm going to write an opinion and I'm going to force it in here with case law where something's not an issue and has not been raised in this case at all.
Does your opposing counsel take the position that they owe no costs at this time?
Does opposing counsel take that position? Mr. Hallman, in his testimony, admits that he did have an obligation to pay costs. He admits to the terms of the contract. He admits to signing it. He admits to even paying cost. That's what I should say. He claims to have paid cost. Your Honor, I don't have much. I don't have much more to really say.
His position is that the costs were increased because of counsel's negligence.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, isn't his position is that he's entitled to damages because his costs have been increased?
That would be a legitimate argument to present if he had shown the difference in the cost at trial.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Now, that's your position is he didn't show it.
He didn't show it. He didn't show any damages, to be honest with you.
Why would he? Because why would he want to show the costs?
Because he's
He doesn't want costs. I mean, he doesn't want his two-thirds to have deductions to until it hits to only $100. He has no vested interest in asserting the costs, none whatsoever. He has a vested interest in saying two-thirds, I know the math, two-thirds, that's what I get. And normally, the burden of proof or the burden of persuasion is tends to someone who has the interest in advancing it. I mean, he wants
two-thirds and then go home and you take care of your costs. I mean, he doesn't want a further deduction. Why would he be wanting to prove up a further deduction? I say, rhetorically, I mean, maybe okay. There's an easy answer, so give me the easy answer.
The easy answer is because the contract requires that costs come out before attorney fees and before he received the settlement, period.
Counsel, Mr. Haldeman says that upon inquiry, your office informed him that he would get about $100 out of the recovery. Is that a matter of record?
No, and that's highly disputed.
Whether it's disputed,
I don't know if the court wants to hear it or not. But
no, whether it's disputed
not in the
or not,
record, you don't want to hear it.
Okay, so because in the briefs, I'm pretty sure this is where I got it from. In the briefs, there was a representation by Mr. Haldeman that he had contacted your office, and your office had told him that he would get about $100. So what I need to know is whether that was part of the testimony or not.
My recollection of the facts, Your Honor, is that the check, when it was issued, there was an appeal that was filed, and any distribution to Mr. Haldeman would not come until months or probably a year later. So what he's asserting is impossible. I mean, you can't sign the check, the settlement check from the insurance company, appeal the case, and issue a check to the client at the same time until the appeal is completed. So it just doesn't track.
Footnote 3 in the Court of Appeals opinion indicates that he testified that he was told at the office that you were keeping $7,000 for fees and the check would be for fees and for him, and I think there was like $100-some left or something like that. So I take it that this, although I don't have the transcript in front of me, I take it that the Court of Appeals, when they put it in quotation marks, that it was part of the record then, the $100-some?
I don't recall, to be honest, Your Honor. Like I said, I know standard procedures. The check was issued from the insurance when their part of the case is over. If the case is appealed, the money stays in trust. So you can't have a signed a check and you only get $100 on the same day.
The question was, what's in the record?
I don't recall.
Do you agree with opposing counsel's statement on the standard of review?
I don't, but I do understand what the standard of review is.
Well, in opposing counsel's brief, he quotes case law suggesting that we are to draw reasonable inferences and view credible evidence in a light most favorable to, in this case, Mr. Haldeman. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
The standard rule for a directed verdict, that would be the standard rule for directed verdict, I would agree.
It arguably, do you think it's reasonable for us to draw an inference that, in fact, Mr. Haldeman did prove his damages, at least to some level, enough to go to the jury in that he testified that perhaps he paid all of the costs so that you didn't incur any on his behalf, so he's entitled to one-third of the second jury verdict. I'm sorry, two-thirds of the second jury verdict.
I don't believe that that's what the testimony reflects, and no, I don't think that that can be shown. I think this is such an open-ended case as far as what the damages are. Nobody could make that determination.
You could. You know what the reasonable necessary costs are.
Yes.
Do you think there should be a different measure of damages in a case like this, which is different than Lewandowski? Do you think that there should be a different measure of damages where the plaintiff actually gets a second trial? Is there any reason we should depart from Lewandowski?
I really don't see how this fits into Lewandowski, in all honesty. Lewandowski sets forth the standards for practice, what standards have to be adhered to by the attorney before a determination of malpractice can be made. Again, this is very different from it because we had the second trial. It was error-free. And while I may disagree with Judge Wasileski, and I'm sure Mr. Haldeman disagrees with Judge Wasileski, the Court of Appeals upheld his decision, and that's the law of the land that we all have to follow. So I don't see anything different. I don't see how this case fits into Lewandowski, to be honest with you, other than to establish the basic standard for malpractice.
So what is the proper measure of damages then in a case like this one?
I don't think one can be established. I don't think one's been proven.
Well, setting aside whether the plaintiff was able to establish his damages, what is the measure of damages legally?
Arguably,
legal standard?
Arguably, if plaintiff were able to get a verdict from the jury and they found in his favor, and he could show that the recovery was $29,000 and costs could be shown, he could arguably say the difference between the first trial and the second trial would be his cost. Because he was equally responsible, 50-50, for the verdict on the first trial. That's what Judge Wasilewski said. Joint several responsibility, by definition, means equally, 50-50. So I think that's the only thing that he could establish is the cost of the second trial. I'm sorry, the appeal.
I'm not sure I understand what your answer to the question is. What do you think the measure of damages is? What exactly?
I'm not saying what the measure of damages is, Your Honor. I'm saying that it could be calculated as showing the difference between the first trial and the second trial.
What in the first trial? The costs in
the
first trial?
And
do you subtract it or add those costs?
I'm sorry?
Are you subtracting these costs or adding them?
If you take the total cost of the case and subtract the cost of the first trial, then you're looking at just the cost of the second trial. I would consider those to be argumentably damages.
The cost of the second trial.
That's what I might argue if I were the plaintiff. But again, there's none shown in this case. So.
And your argument is it doesn't matter what the rule of damages is because none were shown by the plaintiff.
No, I think talking about it is just legal gymnastics because it really doesn't focus on the issue at hand here, and that's whether or not the plaintiff failed to establish the damages.
There was no evidence of damages, period. That's your position.
Any damage. I don't think he showed any damages.
What were the costs in the first trial, and what was the verdict in the first trial?
Verdict was approximately $34,000. The costs were somewhere very close to what the recovery was.
Second trial costs, second trial verdict?
Again, that was approximately $2,000 to $3,000.
The verdict or the cost?
Oh, no, the cost.
Okay, what was the verdict?
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I think you meant the verdict in the second case.
Right. What were the costs in the first case? What was the verdict in the first case?
If they're of record, if they are not of record, I don't believe we should.
I'm speculating. Yes, I'm going from recollection here. That's not part of the record. Nothing was presented.
The verdict. The
first jury award is $182,250. I didn't pull that out of the air. It's
yes.
Part of the record, right?
No, I think you meant the cost.
The first jury award. What was it? $182,000. First costs were about. What?
See, that's 30. I'm concerned about, Justice Eagler. Are those costs in the record?
Well, he said he submitted a check for them, right?
I don't
know. Okay. All right.
If
the second verdict was $36,000, so it was $150,000 less, right?
Approximately, yes.
Okay, and the costs were a lot less, or at least the costs were in the under $10,000.
Yes.
Second.
Correct.
Right? So you might, if you really were working this case up, you might have a lawyer come in and say, well, yeah, I spent a lot more in costs, but the verdict was $150,000 more. I mean, we don't know. Who knows how you would prove this up? Everyone keeps asking you, how do you prove this case? Is it your job to prove the plaintiff's case in this case?
That's his position.
You're the defendant. It's not your job, is it?
No.
And I think that's the, if I may, that's the tug. It's not your job to prove the damages in this case, but it is your job to claim only damages that are reasonable and necessary. In other words, the cost That's the rub.
If that, well, no, because that's not, that was not raised as an issue in this case.
Okay, you've said that before. I think I would hear it by now,
yeah,
wouldn't you?
I mean, it's still true. As a plaintiff's attorney, we've got to prove the case. We've got to go up there and let that jury know that somebody's entitled to damages. And then we have to show what they are and give them a vehicle for making that determination, not making them guess. But that's all we have here.
We as the plaintiff. The plaintiff has the burden of proof, in your opinion.
Absolutely.
Okay. So now we'll hear from the plaintiff.
It is totally illogical in this case that the petitioner at the end of the case has to prove the respondent's costs, as the petitioner would be attacking the respondent's costs. Were we responsible for the costs in the first trial? Were we responsible for the costs in the appeal? Were we responsible for the costs of the second trial? Counsel indicated that he gave Mr. Hellman an accounting when he came into his office, allegedly for the purpose of signing the check. Mr. Hellman testified at the trial that he never did get an accounting. He has no idea what his costs were incurred that were advanced by Mr. Barrick. And if you look at Mr. Barrick's comments that his costs in the second trial were $2,000 to $3,000, assuming the costs in the first trial, because you're trying the case all over again with medical testimony, with doctors, with whatever else you're bringing, the costs in the first trial would probably be $2,000 to $3,000. How do you keep $29,000 when a check is made out to a client and your name? Why didn't he go to a court and get an order indicating that he could cash the check or put it in his trust account? Why was that money not given to Mr. Hellman at any time? Why didn't he get even $100? He got nothing.
Well, Mr. Levine, I think that's the question that you were supposed to answer.
Who was I going to ask, Judge? I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
You were going to ask Mr. Barrick that.
Well, Mr. Barrick acknowledged that he didn't give Mr. Hellman any money and told him he could have $100.
Right. So the question is, why? Why is he only going to get $100? And the answer, if I might delve into the tea leaves, is, well, that was all expense. And then the question is, well, how much of it was attributable to the second trial? That's the question that has to be answered, right?
Correct.
And you just said, how are you to know that? Well, if you don't know how to know that, then how's the jury supposed to know that?
Well, but if Mr. Bear takes the stand, he's going to explain. I don't want to prove his costs. Let him prove his costs. I'm interested.
But that's your case. Your case is you want your costs, right?
I don't agree. I respectfully disagree with the court. I don't want the cost. I want to knock down as much of the cost, especially under the facts of this case.
All right. Well, let's look at that a little bit more closely then. So if your position is that what you're entitled to is two-thirds of the award and that you didn't get it, now we're talking about conversion, not a matter of malpractice and recovering damages because you had to go through a second trial. Now you're saying there's two-thirds of a check that he's holding that does not belong to him. That's a different cause of action, isn't it?
I agree.
Did you bring that cause of action?
Not yet. We didn't notify OLR yet either, but that's coming.
Okay, so, but for the purposes of this case, the fact that you want two-thirds of the award doesn't amount to a hill of the beans, does it?
On the $29,000, yeah. It amounts to almost $20,000.
Well, that would be two-thirds, yes, but you've not advanced any reason why you get that in this case.
Well, I believe we get it because, again, I agree that we don't have, or I feel that we don't have the burden of proving the cost that an attorney advanced. You come into my office, I give you a settlement agreement, including a copy of whatever costs we advance. You sign the settlement agreement, you know what the costs are. In this instance, that didn't happen. My client never got that.
But that's a different question, right? So you're either going for costs because you had to go through a second trial, and you shouldn't have to be responsible for the additional costs, or you're going for two-thirds of the award, And there's different ways to getting to each of those numbers. To get to the cost number, that's a malpractice question. To get to the two-thirds number, that's conversion.
Okay.
Right?
I agree.
Okay. Well, you didn't bring conversion here.
But if Mr. Barrett doesn't take the stand, if he never testifies, then we're entitled to two-thirds. If he doesn't show up, if he's not there, whatever it is.
But only if you've claimed that he's converted the two-thirds.
I'm sorry.
But you're entitled to that only if you claim and prove that he converted two-thirds of the award that belonged to your client.
In this case, it wouldn't even be conversion at that point because there'd be no testimony that he took the money. We just know he got the check for $29,000. So we would be entitled to two-thirds. When he later takes the money, at least based upon Mr. Hubman's testimony, where he testifies, I've advanced $10,000 to $15,000 in costs, that's an issue of fact for a jury. They can make the determination. But I think this case, at that stage of the evidence, when we presented our case, if you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff at that point, that case should have continued, and the court should never have dismissed this case.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for a very interesting case, and we are going to take our lunch break now. We will reconvene at 1:30 for our next case of the day.